Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Josh. Just a quick word. You're going to hear a great episode of The Movies That Made Me. I just want to give you a heads up. A couple of the films we talk about involve sexual abuse and rape. And if that's going to upset you, I hate to say it, you should probably skip this one. Also, there are some faint Canadian accents too, so just be warned.
This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
Literally only listen to the WKRP in Cincinnati podcast. It's like the only podcast
I've What heard. Do they do? Do they do like an episode by episode breakdown?
Yeah, it's like every episode covers two episodes of WKRP, but they also look at like all of American sort of culture, politics, everything like through the lens of WKRP.
But didn't you Pretty once amazing. Have your own podcast?
I never had a podcast.
No?
Really?
You're just a frequent guest.
I don't know. Was I a guest on a podcast?
I don't know. I've never heard of you.
I've been on a couple, like a Rumorg podcast, maybe, okay. And
yeah,
occasional things.
For those associations, yeah. The Diabolique Association.
And the WKRP one. I kind of love that.
Good.
Yeah.
You still, can you get those yet? The show? Because there was that problem with the music. I remember where they couldn't put
No,
out.
No, they solved that, apparently.
Did they solve that?
There's a set that costs like $5,000. The show factory has is missing a few of the songs.
But they put most of them back in, yeah. And that was because that was like a years long effort to try to.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was the problem with a lot of shows. So I remember like I loved Wise Guy. And there was like this key, like in the first season, there was this amazing episode that used a whiter shade of pale to incredible effect.
Well, you have to make sure
they've deleted the music's gone.
And you can use it more than twice.
Yeah.
Well, WKRP even had like dialogue that got replaced with totally different dialogue.
Right, because they're talking about the songs.
Because
and
they
stuff.
Had to cover. Yeah, they weren't allowed to actually mention. At some point in the show, there was like somebody says to Bailey something about like, you know, he makes a reference to Tiny Dancer, the Elton John song.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be some romantic in joke between them. And then they couldn't use that lyric in the dialogue. So they had to remove it and replace it with something. And so this dubbed in voice says, "Hold my order, terrible dresser," which is what the podcast
fit
is called. So they called the
podcast. Oh, wow. That's great. I love that. Hold my order, terrible dresser.
Right. I've heard a couple of episodes of that podcast. Yeah. But other than that, yours is the only one I've ever listened to.
Oh, well, I don't even listen on my own.
Have you ever listened?
To ours?
Yeah.
I wanted to see if you screwed it up.
It's
fine. No, they're fine. And there's lots of cutaways to music and
Sometimes. You know, we've got one coming up where I didn't cut anything just because it was
so long.
You'll hear.
Sometimes we split them into two if they.
Well, also sometimes it just feels that we do a lot of, you know, we'll do a little cutaway when you sort of mention a film to maybe part of the trailer, but sometimes there are no trailers. And then sometimes it just sort of disrupts the mood entirely.
Yeah, that's true. And sometimes we don't talk about it long enough to justify it.
Yeah. Or sometimes somebody brings up two films.
So I should let the uninitiated know who we're talking to.
Sure, why don't you do that?
Ladies first.
Oh, good.
Kirla Janice is the founder of the Muscatonic Institute for Horror Studies and the owner of the small press publisher Spectacular Optical, which began as a website. She's a writer, actress, film programmer, and producer of a great documentary called Eurocrime, Italian cop and gangster movies, which is a required viewing for anybody who's interested in that period from like the 60s to the 80s. It's really a terrific documentary with all sorts of great people in it.
Wait, is there a live like a cop, die like a man conversation we can have?
Or is there a what?
A live like a cop, die like a man conversation
we can have? Oh, yeah, no, that's definitely covered in there.
Okay. No, she hits them all. She's got all these great people.
Well, it's directed by Mike Malloy, so he sort of wrote it, edited it, everything. So it's kind of his baby, but.
I'm weirdly obsessed with that one.
And she also produced a documentary about Richard Stanley's abortive Island of Lost Souls.
Oh, no, I'm just in that.
Oh, you're not?
I didn't produce it. I'm just in it.
Also, she's the author of House of Psychotic Women, an autobiographical topography of female neurosis in horror and exploitation films.
Yes.
A great book.
Yes.
And also Sonic Panic, a pop cultural paranoia of the 80s, and The Violent Professional is another book that she's written. Yeah. And that's just in addition to all the other stuff.
I know, these
she's
are serious
on, she's on every panel that I ever go to, every horror fest, every whatever. She's just inescapable.
Does she like movies?
Apparently. Well, you know those Canadians.
Better hope so. We have
if
an hour.
It's cold, so, there's no place to go.
That's right.
So also, we have Calum Vatnsnal, who is also Canadian. It's
Canadian.
Canuck Day.
Yes.
Are we your first Canadians? That's what I want
to know. But you're here, though, right?
I live here.
Yes.
No, well, they live here. But they're
no, he doesn't.
I'm just visiting.
Oh, that's right. You live in Winnipeg.
Yeah, he came all the way.
he's the author of They Came From Within, a history of Canadian horror cinema.
Oh, where'd you get the title?
Your pal, David Cronenberg.
Oh, that guy.
Well, that's the American title for the movie.
Are you really?
So I'm just
really,
reclaiming
really,
it. Yeah.
You're going to tell me that.
Also, King Delirium, which is the films of Guy Maddin, for whom he has actually acted. And closest to my heart, of course, is You Don't Know Me, But You Love Me,
the definitive
book about my late friend and collaborator, Dick Miller.
Yeah.
He claims to be a fan of the show, by the way.
I know. He says he's heard every episode. Yes.
I think I have. I've even
and
heard
he came anyway.
The Roger and Julie episode.
That just dropped today. I know. Yeah. Which gives away when we're recording this. We sit on them sometimes.
Yeah, we don't show them in the order that we record them.
Yes. And well, thank you. So you are both authors. Yeah. So we have not had a lot of authors on the show. We thought it'd be fun to grab a few and talk to you about excuse me,
ringtone. It's the ringtone.
I know. Yours is yet to go off. Joe's always goes off during the episode. He's got a great ringtone. Don, that's not so good.
I'll have somebody call.
Thank you for coming in. And we wanted, because both of you are sort of specialists in, I hate to say things like esoteric because it's not, and certainly not to our
just
listeners.
Say genre. It's such a classy word.
I hate genre, but you know, we're not going to be talking about Top Gun here, which is, you know, a terrible shame because I've never seen Top Gun.
I've never seen Top Gun.
Never seen Top Gun. No.
I had to watch it to see Meg Ryan.
Is she it? Wait, Meg Ryan is it? Yeah. I thought it was someone else.
Fairly.
Well, Meg Ryan is the girlfriend of Anthony Edwards.
That was a big break for her.
Really?
Okay.
I didn't even know she was in it. I thought it was Kelly.
She's the main girl.
She's the main girl. Okay. I see her at my grocery store sometimes. Lovely woman. We're out of time. But no, I thought it'd be interesting to get you guys to, you know, because one of the things that we try to do on the show is, you know, we have listeners who are faced with these mountains of choices and there's no kind of vetting process anymore. You know, it's just sort of there's 20 billion movies out there. And if you didn't grow up with this stuff, it's hard to know where to go. So we thought it'd be interesting to each have you guys bring in some movies that you wish more people knew, which I know at least. I mean, it's great having Joe here because Joe has, he's going to yell at me, seen everything.
I have not.
The thing I love about an episode like this is I feel like I'm probably going to spend most of the time going, oh, that sounds good. But you brought in each of you a list of some movies that you want and wish more people had seen. Is that?
Yeah, I would say that's the case, except for one movie. I was sort of rewatching it again in preparation for this, and I was like, maybe I don't want to tell people they should watch this.
That sounds like you have to start with that.
I think I know the movie you're talking about.
Do you want to start with it?
Yeah, Water Power. Sean Costello's Water Power, which is a triple X movie that came out in 1977. And it is, I don't have you guys seen Water Power?
I have seen Water Power.
I somehow it escaped me.
Yeah. It's, have you heard of it?
Yeah. So I was sort of thinking I probably shouldn't, you know, maybe
but now
like
you have to.
Telling people you should watch this movie is probably not what I want to do. Maybe saying it's an underrated movie or that it's been kind of approached in the wrong way by previous critics would be fair, but saying that people should go out and try to look for it and watch it. It's not going to be for everybody.
Are they going to be able to find it?
They'll be able to find it. Okay. There is a DVD on Amazon, which may be cut.
I don't know what would be left if they cut that movie.
Well, I think, because really, they don't sell XXX, so they would have to. Or do they?
I don't know. I mean, like, yeah, because they're supposedly don't on Amazon. They don't supposedly tell. But it, I mean, it's a porno movie for sure. And, you know, it's considered one of the notorious kind of roughy porno movies of the 70s. And the title refers to...
oh, God.
Enemas.
Oh, it's even worse. Well,
yeah, it's worse. How, whatever you think, it's worse than you think. It's probably the only... Anima porn movie that Bernard Herrmann scored, though.
Off records.
So,
yes. It's basically like
that was the standard.
Illegal use of music.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure we have crossed the XXX Rubicon or anything. Mark Ebner brought in one or two. But this is, I believe, the first Enema movie that we've discussed.
Well, it's a small field.
It's, I actually don't know.
And based on a true case. I guess I'll let Kayla talk
now
about
it. Okay, keep going. A true case of what?
It's based on the case of this guy named the Enema Bandit. That was like his what the media called him.
Well, that's what the media and Frank Zappa called him.
And Frank Zappa wrote a song about him.
Yeah.
Which is like the Enema Bandit.
The Illinois Enema Bandit or something.
How widespread was this story at the time?
Widespread enough that they made this movie based on it, you know? So it was like they heard about it and decided to make the movie. And Jamie Gillis, who is the main character who plays the Enema Bandit in the movie, supposedly was trying to, you know, to research his role, was trying to get the producers to fly him to Chicago to interview the actual Enema Bandit in jail. And of course, it's a porno production. So they're like, you're crazy. We're not going to fly you anywhere.
We have $15,000 to make this movie. We're not...
But it's interesting because it starts right in the, with Jamie Gillis right in the middle of the bicentennial celebrations. It's 1977. He's walking through the streets
76.
In New York. And it's just all these bicentennial like parade and stuff happening. And
there it is. That's the Joe phone. Yes. Once per episode. Please hold. We never cut these out.
No, I'll just tell them. Hi, I'm podcasting. I can't do that. Bye.
I wish you told
me.
He never cuts them out. I wish you had said what we were talking about.
I didn't want to.
please
go any further.
By the way, if you want to take the whole episode, we can have you back.
So Jamie Gillis is wandering around New York in the middle of bicentennial celebrations, and it's obviously like just real stuff that they're just filming him on the street interacting with real people, and he gets his photo
in character
taken. Oh yeah, no, he's well because he's very much like a Travis Bickle type of character.
Got it.
Like that's probably the movie it's been compared to the most is Taxi Driver.
Also with a Bernard
so angry
score. The same score.
Angry man. Wandering the streets, and he's very sexually repressed. He's got an apartment that's just full of, pullouts from porno magazines and things like that taped up on the wall, and he reads porno magazines.
Like Travis Bickle does too, I think.
And he doesn't, he supposedly has a girlfriend because a woman pops in partway through the movie yelling at him about where he hasn't talked to her for 2 weeks. But he goes to a brothel in Times Square, and it is run by Gloria Leonard, and Sharon Mitchell works there as famous porno actress. And Long John Silver, or Long Jean Silver, I guess is how you would say her name.
Right.
Porno star who has one leg.
Oh, yes. Stump.
She was famous for.
That's as opposed to Long Dong Silver, who is a different porno.
But so she works there too, and he goes in and he doesn't know what he wants. You know, like they're trying to get him to say what he wants, and he's just not sure because he's, you know, it's not until he sees a sort of fake scenario at the brothel where a fake doctor who is actually a customer who wants to play a doctor as part of his fantasy or whatever, played by Eric Edwards, gives an enema to a patient played by Long Jean Silver, and Jamie Gillis's character happens to see this and discovers that, you know, from behind a glass wall, you know, glass window, he's looking upon this. And this is when he realized that this is his thing. This is the thing that makes him really excited. And if you've ever seen In Fabric, the Peter Strickland movie that just came out.
I have not seen it yet, but I know of it. Yeah.
There is a scene that's in that movie that is an homage to this scene.
There's an homage to Water Power. Yeah. Wow.
There's
so
a
like
scene
a homage to Human Centipede, you know. You don't see too many of
them. People have seen that. By the way, I hate to, I was just looking at 22 minutes have been excised from the DVD on Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah. 22? So, that's a lot of
Yeah,
minutes.
You might want to, yeah.
How many animas is that?
I think there's four.
And I'm, so, okay.
So now, he gets into this and then he ends up, he's basically a serial rapist, but he's going around and breaking into women's houses to cleanse them of their vile humors.
Does he bring Fleet enemas, or is it in a bag, or how does he? How does
it's
he...
like a, so you know about it. They actually explain how enemas work in the movie, like detailed, just
sure,
in
right?
case.
Yeah.
No, but the doctor is like explaining.
Well, anybody who's had a colonoscopy has to learn what an enema is. So you know, it's not, it's pretty well known.
Yeah. No, I know what I mean. I think
it's
everybody's...
like a bag hanging on something that is then connected to a tube, and it's right. like it looks like a turkey baster to me.
Yeah. Well, they look like are they like hot water bottles kind of
right?
Yeah.
So that's the one you're not going to recommend.
That's the one where I was like, maybe I shouldn't be recommending this one to people.
I'm curious as to what about it
appealed to you to begin.
Well, also, I mean, but for instance, you know, clearly you're serious about this stuff, and you know, it's if you're homaging these things, any serious, there's what is the quality of this film that?
I mean, it definitely just feels like one of those sort of New York, angry New York movies, you know, like right. that, and to me, like Triple X movies from that era. So many of them, you know, they just play like movies. They happen to have like these graphic sex scenes in them. But there's another one called Climax of Blue Power that is also considered a very rough porno film from that era. It's got car chases. It's got like crazy psychological profiling and dialogue and everything. I mean, it's, you know, it's just this sort of era of movies where things were kind of in the middle, where the Triple X movies still had a significant amount of story and character development and stuff. And so I just like it because it is such an angry movie. And it seems kind of like, as much as, you know, people like on first glance, you would look at it and you would be like, this is such a misogynistic movie. It's like this guy hates women. He goes around giving women forced enemas because he thinks they're all dirty and they need to be cleansed. But it feels very much almost like a critique, you know, of that kind of toxic masculinity.
Do you think consciously or?
No, I think it is because Sean Costello made a movie before it called Forced Entry.
Oh, I was going to mention that.
And that movie, you know, I was there's been scholarship about that movie and stuff. And they talk about how that movie was also very much a critique. It's about a Vietnam vet who's got PTSD, played by Harry Reams. And he comes back and he's very angry. And he basically, you know, it's sort of implied that he has, you know, they're playing footage from Vietnam atrocities, you know, committed by Americans and stuff like this. And it's supposed to be like that implied that he went over, was in the war, got screwed up, and then came back and is enacting these kinds of things on women. And so I feel as though the fact that Sean Costello made two of these movies in a row, it just, they feel very much like much of a pair and kind of like very critical of the type of stuff that people accuse the movies of being, you know, like people think like, oh, these are like the worst.
You
movies.
Are the thing you're critiquing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I do feel like it's actually deliberate. So.
Yeah. You have to also remember how rape was a staple.
Oh no! It's insane
in the '70s. Yeah, in exploitation movies. I mean, in not
exploitation just, films in mainstream.
No, mainstream exploitation films.
Yeah,
It was just that was a plot point. You have to have that. You know, and if it was supposed to be a good movie, then you took a little time to see the victim looking in the mirror and feeling bad and reacting to the terrible thing that had happened. But for the most part, that stuff got cut out.
But not in, I mean, it's always, you know, I people love it. It is far from my favorite Leone film, but you know, you go to Once Upon a Time in America and it's just, there's this running gag where, you know, they just rape Tuesday Weld every time she shows up and it's a big laugh for everyone. And it's amazing watching that today, because I remember at the time watching it going, oh, this is kind of uncomfortable. And you watch it now and it's just, it's fucking horrifying. You know,
but like Nashville Girl is one of my favorite movies and she gets raped. It's a similar thing where it's almost played for laughs, like how much it's like anytime she meets someone, they rape her.
Like Miss 45 too, everyone she meets.
Well, but that at least is attempting to.
But that's like, that is a rape revenge movie. Nashville Girl is supposed to be like a comedy set in the
a musical comedy,
scene, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a movie called Rape Squad.
Right.
I mean, it was right in the title.
In Water Power, he walks past a marquee for Rape Squad and like stops. And
but is that just, not, it's been a long, that's a bunch of women going after rape, is that correct? So it's at least it's that element. And the one I'm always, you know, I remember showing my wife Nancy, who had not seen it and loves Westerns. You know, I had to sit down and sort of prep her. I was like, understand it was this era, and then show her High Plains Drifter. Because if you're not ready for High Plains Drifter and watching it today, it's just, you know, the first thing he does when he gets to town is you know, he rapes a woman practically on the street.
But the thing in this movie, they all love it.
Right, exactly. Because, yeah, she comes back for it. It's insane. It's completely insane. So, wow.
Well, at least we started the show off on a high note.
Where do you go from there?
I know. Well, what's...
what have you got to say for yourself?
Well, I mean, I'm cheating with my first movie, which is Design for a Living, which... it's a bit, you know...
Who says this show isn't eclectic?
God damn it.
Design for a Living has totally had its all, you know, I mean, it's well beloved by everyone. But back when I first saw it, which is many, many, many years ago, I saw, I think, a bootleg cassette of it, or it seemed like a bootleg cassette. I worked at a video store and we got a lot of cassettes from this place in Chicago that had these big, thick catalogs of VHS tapes that they would release. And Design for a Living, I remember, was one of them. And, you know, that was the first movie I watched where I got the Lubitsch touch. I'd seen a few of them already. And Trouble in Paradise always seemed to get all the accolades to me. Like, it seemed like there was, I paired them up in my mind for some reason, the two movies. And Trouble in Paradise always seemed to get the kudos. And I was always forever saying for years until I wasn't the only one, I guess, but I was championing Design for a Living. So I spent years championing it, which is why I've brought it along. But it's since had, of course, a Criterion release and all the accolades it can probably handle. So we don't...
Well, it's always...
We can go back and talk more about Water Power.
I don't think Preston Sturges ever did an enema film.
No, Lubitsch didn't either.
Oh, sorry. No. At least, why am I going straight?
You know what? I pair those two guys in my mind too, and I occasionally will mix them up.
So I'm not a complete idiot.
I always think of those as the two guys who didn't make the anime movies.
Jesus.
There's probably something to discover about both their careers back in the old country.
Wow. That is one of the more interesting intersections we've had on the show. Yeah. But no, I think even stuff, you know, I mean, it's great that stuff's out on Criterion, obviously, but I think even that stuff gets kind of lost in the shuffle over there sometimes.
I think so. And there's so many by this point that have been released on Criterion. So it's not
necessarily a benchmark. They just did their 1,000th Blu-ray, the Godzilla set. So that was, I think it was number 1,000 in their series. Yeah. Every Godzilla movie. Every Toho.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't think Design for a Living can really be recommended enough because I think everyone should see it. It's just, I mean, I watched a little bit of it again last night in preparation for this and just found myself laughing once again. And so
I think that's one of the reasons, as you said, that you like to watch old movies is because you can come in almost at any point because chances are you've already seen it.
Yeah.
And you just drop right into that rhythm. You know, it's as if you had watched the whole thing from the beginning.
Exactly. And I'm still astonished that you could put Edward Everett Horton and Franklin Pangborn into one movie.
It blows
my mind that anyone would even think to do that, much less do it. I mean, I love it for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird to see them in the same place at the same time.
It's like Charles Durning and Brian Dennehy being in the same movie, or Lee Marvin and James Coburn. Like, you know, you wouldn't pair those guys up together.
Exactly. Fantastic. Well, what's next on your list?
I think if we're going to try to go with this contrast, why don't I go with Melody next, which is the children's movie.
With the cast of Oliver, right?
Yeah.
I've never seen it either.
Amazing.
It's a Bee Gees movie.
Yeah. Bee Gees, early Bee Gees. All the music is done by like Odessa era Bee Gees.
Okay.
And it's Waris Hussein who made it, written by Alan Parker. So it's like an early script by Alan Parker. And it's the two stars of Oliver reunited a couple years later. And it's made in 1971, and it's a puppy love movie, essentially. So it's like Mark Lester is this little boy, goes to a British private school, meets up with this sort of naughty kid from the other side of the tracks named Ornshaw, played by Jack Wilde.
The Artful Dodger.
And they become best friends and pal around. But then there's this girl named Melody, played by Tracy Hyde, who shows up at the school, and Mark Lester's character, who is the very nice shy boy, the one who played Oliver, becomes enraptured by her and determined to talk to her and meet her and stuff. And so eventually they meet at a dance and decide that they're in love and they are going to get married. And they are they're supposed to be like 10, you know, in the movie. I think they were actually about 12 or maybe right. even 14, you know, at the time. Jack Wilde may have actually been like 19 when he made the movie because he just was playing really young, like far into his career. But so they decide they're going to run away and get married. And it's this just adorable movie about like the parents trying to explain to them that they can't get married, that they're too young to get married. And they just don't understand why the world is against them, you know? And it's just this beautiful movie. And if you've ever seen Moonrise Kingdom, it's very influenced by this movie.
Sure. Well,
that makes sense. And actually I have kind of a funny story about it, which is that I have a 16 millimeter print of Melody. And I played it at the Alamo Draft House in Austin years ago when it was still like the single screen original theater. And a friend of mine saw it and he ended up being a Roman Coppola's assistant. And so he gave a copy. He tracked down a bootleg copy of the movie because he loved it so much and gave it to Roman Coppola. And then Roman Coppola wrote Moonrise Kingdom.
Wow.
So my 16 millimeter print was potentially 2 degrees away from that movie getting written.
Yeah, that seems like a straight line. Yeah. Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah, I love Moonrise Kingdom. I'm not. Can you find Melody?
Yeah, it's on British Blu-ray, and it was weirdly like it's never had a proper release here. It may have been on VHS.
It was a very small company that released it, and it didn't push it very much.
It was like, was it Good Times? I'm trying to remember if it was Good Times. Same company that did like That'll Be the Day and Stardust. There was few of these movies where David Putnam.
Right. That didn't get seen the way they should have been.
Yeah.
Because Stardust is a really very good movie.
Yeah.
I like it better than That'll Be the Day.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was huge in Japan. So if you go to like an Asian karaoke bar,
they're doing the Bee Gees songs for Melody.
But it'll be specifically like Melody Fair and the ones like from the movie.
Wow.
Because it was huge in Asia.
Is it a Robert Stigwood production? I mean, is that why the Bee Gees are involved? Yeah.
No, this is pre-Stigwood.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It was shot by Peter Sushitsky, I know. And that's I remember when I was a teenager in London, I went and knocked on his door because I was such a fan of his cinematography. Yeah, he wasn't home. he was working with John Borman on some movie in Toronto.
I know the gentleman. Obviously, yeah.
He shot, of course, he shot History of Violence.
Lovely man. Incredible,
so I've heard.
Incredible talent. God. I remember telling him we were just on a particularly cold day. It was like, he said, what's your next project? I said, I don't know, but I'm going to shoot something in the Bahamas. And he said, I will be your DP. I think it had more to do with the Bahamas than, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
but now I just have to come up with something for the Bahamas and I've got a cinematographer. What's next, Kim?
Oh, next. What's next for me? Oh, The Errand Boy. Now, The Errand Boy is a movie I'm guessing is close to your heart, Joe, because you kind of recreated, you know, the boardroom scene in the Looney Tunes movie. Instead of the Paramutuals, it's the Warner Brothers themselves. And, of course, Kathleen Freeman's in it, too, which you've worked with her a couple of times. So
this is the Jerry Lewis Loose in a Movie Studio movie.
Yeah, yes. Jerry Lewis. And the reason it's close to my heart, I mean, there's many reasons it's close to my heart, but a movie I'll be talking about later, Careful, which was the first movie I worked on. I was the second camera assistant and the clapper loader. And I came up with this idea for a movie called The Clapper Loader. And the movie would begin with in some studio situation where they're doing a birth scene. And a woman with a fake stomach is giving birth and she acts and they cut. And then there's a real baby on the thing and they don't know where this baby's come from, but the studio raises him and he becomes like a Jerry Lewis type Schlemiel and he becomes the clapper loader. And of course, there's many things that can happen to a clapper loader that are very hilarious.
So
at this point, I had
not. Do we get a piece if somebody.
It's like the bellboy with a clapper.
Yeah, if somebody hears the pitch on our show and it gets made, are we producers?
Yeah, I mean, this is an idea I had when I was 19 or 20, and I hadn't seen, I don't think, I certainly had not seen nor heard of The Errand Boy. I had seen maybe a couple of Jerry Lewis movies, and I never was a Jerry Lewis uber fan, but when I finally did see The Errand Boy, and I realized that he had, you know, 20, 30 years earlier, he'd made. The clapper loader, essentially. I was pretty beguiled by it. And I just find it very, very funny. The only scenes I don't find funny are anything with there's a character called Mr. Sneak, who's like this guy who's been driven mad by his own sycophancy toward the paramutuals. But other than that, it's a great movie.
Except for the puppets.
Yeah, you're right.
Some very maudlin scenes with Jerry.
Well, that's Jerry Lewis, though.
Which it's, you know, it's a raucous comedy, but every so often it just slows down to be maudlin. And it's not an accident that, you know, the Sammy Maudlin character from SCTV was partially based on that part of the Jerry.
Oh, really? Okay.
That makes a lot of sense. But his boss, his direct boss in the studio is pretty funny, who played him.
Brian Donlevy.
Well, no, Brian Donlevy plays the head of the studio, yeah, but Stanley Baker, the guy who plays, they just call him Grumpy.
The British actor?
No. He was a character actor who worked a lot, but never really got that traction to become, but he's perfect in this movie. He sits there and he does the slow burn thing, and he barks at people, and I don't know, his scenes are the funniest in the picture, if you ask me. I was going to do an impression of him, but I don't think I should, because this is actually going to be listened to by people. So
is this the movie that turned you into, or like that converted you to Jerry? Is that the?
It is. No, I'm still not what I would call a big. I mean,
no, there's
like
Jerry
him.
Movies and there's Jerry movies.
Yeah, I appreciate.
I mean, you have to if you're careful what you pick out.
Yeah,
there are some good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no. Yeah.
I mean,
but when you get to stuff like Which Way to the Front, right. Hardly Working, and. Movies that are so blatantly egotistical.
But there's a thing. I mean, I remember being for a long time, I actually think of Jerry Lewis and Bob Dylan kind of the same way, where there's just whole chunks of my life where it's just like, ugh, ugh. Yeah. And then one day, you know, somebody plays the right thing or shows you the right sequence or something, and you suddenly
see
a thing you never saw before. I enjoy a good Jerry Lewis movie. I love Bob Dylan.
Hardly Working is the first one of his that I ever saw, and it's the one that I ever watched.
Yeah, why would you go back?
That's the product placement movie. That's the movie where there's the Dunkin' Donuts box, and every time the camera moves, the Dunkin' Donuts box moves so you can read Dunkin' Donuts. On Harold J. Stone's desk when they're talking, and I was just astonished at how resourceful he was in plugging, and it's filled with things like that. The whole movie is filled with plugs because he had no money, made it in Florida, and obviously this was the way he financed the movie. But it was a surprise hit, although I think it was on the shelf for a while. But then when it came out, it was sort of a resurgence for him because it was actually quite popular.
It played on some kind of cable channel a lot, I think, endlessly, and that's how I saw it.
Mm. Yeah. But I mean, to me, it's like, you know, imagine your first Marx Brothers film is like A Night in Casablanca or something. Like,
I think if it's the coconuts, it might be a little difficult too.
You know.
I mean, that's a stage play, and it's very broad, and there's a lot of Zeppo.
Yeah, I actually read that one before.
Zeppo's in a lot of Duck Soup, actually.
Yep,
which has been in the news lately because of the various things that are going on in the world. Zeppo was smart, I think, when he got out, because he was sort of the guy that they gave the exposition to.
Yeah. Yeah. Poor Gummo, who never got a moment on screen. I remember that was one of the Annobile books, I think they did. Or no, they did Chunks from Coconuts in the...
Coconut Chunks.
Yeah, Chunks of... Yes. in the Wyatt Duck book. Yeah. I believe, wasn't it? You had segments. Do you remember Richard Annobile, who would do these? I'm getting blank looks from our guests. I should just cut this. Late 70s, mm-hmm. early 80s.
They were Fiumettis.
He'd do these books where they would be
still blow-ups. And they,
yep. And then bits of script underneath.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I've certainly seen that.
And they started, he did W.C. Fields and Marx Brothers, where he did segments first, right. And then he started doing entire films.
I know, but it was never funny the way he did it.
I couldn't see these movies, you know, we didn't have VHS and, you know, I'd see one great Marx Brothers film and then that was it. So it was as close as you could get.
Yeah, that's true.
Which was kind of nice. But I also feel like talking about someone whose career just ended as soon as VHS took off. It was nothing left for him to do. But
funny, I was just, when he was talking about Jerry Lewis, I was thinking of like a tiny piece of trivia that relates to Water Power again, which is that... Jerry Lewis movie, Boing Boing.
Oh, yeah. Boing
which
Boing.
Which I hate because it's like, I actually love airline-related movies. We were talking about this on the way over. I love airline movies. And so I watched Boing Boing, which I hate. And but apparently at some point, you know, because it was based on a stage play, one of the actors who's in Water Power, Eric Edwards, had been married to another softcore actress named Chris Jordan, who, if you ever have ever seen Joe Sarno's movie, Confessions of a Young American Housewife, she plays the neighbor who is always eating. But so she and Eric Edwards were married, and they were in a production of Boing Boing that was
traveling around, a stage production.
Wow. And apparently Eric Edwards did a ton of stage work before he ended up in Water Power. But that's a digression.
Did Eric Edwards later become a cameraman?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that might
be. There's a DP by that name.
I wonder if
it's. Sometimes you never know. With people's careers, they can go in crazy loops.
Yeah, although, I mean, and speaking of that type of stuff, I mean, I'm doing a book about Cockfighter, which I interviewed you, Joe, for.
I saw that you were,
And one of the people that I have been trying to get an interview with, and we keep missing each other, is the first AD of the movie, is a guy named Don Walters, who was a porno director.
Oh.
Like that, he was like, before and after Cockfighter, that was his job. And
it was made down south, and so he was obviously there putting the crew together from whoever they could.
But it was weird because his other movies are, I think, New York productions, and I'm just sort of like, that's one of the things I want to interview him about, is like, how did that happen?
Yeah, right.
You know? Well, there's also that from the documentary, the guy who worked with Wells, who was his DP.
Oh, Gary Graver.
Yeah, go off and do porn films, and then go off and shoot for.
Oh, he used to spend his time making porno, directing porno, and directing regular movies too.
Yeah.
And shooting everything, every picture that anybody ever asked me to do. And it was so that he could afford to work for Orson, because Orson couldn't pay him.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
And I guess Mac Ahlberg fits into that
and
category.
I worked with Mac too, who was a really sweet guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. He shot the Second Civil War. Oh, right. And he directed I, a Woman and a number of those Swedish sexploitation pictures fairly artfully, I would say. And he was just the nicest man. He did a lot of mainstream.
He did the Brady Bunch movie.
Yeah. Yeah. He did some John Landis movies too, I think.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Okay, so
transitioning
to whatever. What else was I going to talk about? So I had like Water Power, Melody.
You were going to talk about The Devil at Your Heels.
Oh, yeah, Devil at Your Heels. Yes. I mean, like, we got to represent Canada, I guess, to some extent. And Devil at Your Heels is a movie that was made by the National Film Board of Canada in 1981. And it's a movie that I discovered not actually through being Canadian at all. It was, like, kind of a roundabout way. The movie had become a hit in Australia and New Zealand in the 90s.
Came out in, like... It's 81?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was maybe 10 or 15 years later, it sort of had a resurgence down under. And my friend Anthony Timpson, who is now a producer, at the time he was running a film festival. Yeah. But he was running a film festival called the Incredibly Strange Film Festival. Mm. And so he saw this movie, totally fell in love with it, and produced one of his first films that he produced was a movie called The Devil Dared Me To, which was totally inspired by Devil at Your Heels. His movie is about two stuntmen who have this like long-standing feud, you know, over many years. But Devil at Your Heels is a true story of this guy, Ken Carter, whose nickname was the Mad Canadian. And he was a stuntman. He wanted to be the best stuntman in the world. And he wanted to fly or drive, whatever you would call it,
it's like a rocket car
a mile. So from the Canadian border, flying over the St. Lawrence Seaway and landing in New York. So this was going to be the biggest jump. And it's a crazy story because, you know, it begins, it kind of gives his history that he started when he was 16 or something, doing motorcycle stunts on fire and then moving up to car daredevil stunts and things. But by the time he's, you know, they're making this movie, he's already 20 years into his career. He's saying, yes, I want to, you know, we're going to build this car. We're going to build this giant ramp. We're going to go over the St. Lawrence Seaway. And then you're like, they're like, oh, have you ever driven a rocket car? And he's like, no, I'm going to learn today, you know? And you're like, well,
They're building it though, right? It's
yeah,
not
so
like
they're
it's
building
not,
the car, but yeah. Rocket cars exist before this. So okay. It's like, there are still other rocket, you know, so he eventually like trains with a rocket car guy, you know, and drives and somebody else's car.
A rocket car guy who clearly does not want this guy driving his rocket car.
No.
I'm a rocket. Have you seen this?
And he also shows up
YouTube.
For
you
his rocket
it.
Car lesson with no helmet or protective
he
padding.
He's a kind of a hefty guy and he can't fit into the suit, the fire suit that he's supposed to be wearing. Or he can barely fit into the car. Like they have to stuff him. They cram him into this car.
And but yeah, it's like obviously like when you're a stuntman or a daredevil, you're putting yourself in unsafe situations on a regular basis, but it seems like in many situations, some of the, you know, it's a bit absurd, you know, some of the situations that he's being put in. And of course, it's a Canadian movie, so it's all filmed very straight.
Yes.
Dry, and with constant narration by Gordon Pinsent, of all people. Constantly, it's like Casino in terms of the narration, but it's Gordon Pinsent saying, once again, it does not work out for Ken.
Yeah, things never go well for the poor guy.
You've seen the movie.
Yeah, a friend of mine, it may be the last movie I ever watched on VHS because a friend of mine was raving about it forever and gave me his VHS, but long into the DVD, you know, long after the point where most of us had disconnected and moved on to
You haven't seen my basement.
But I still had a player and I remember I hooked it up and ran it through my projector. It looked pretty awful, but it's now on it's on YouTube.
And the NFB site. Yeah. I should plug the NFB site because my wife is a producer for the NFB. So,
National Film Board of Canada. They pretty much put on their website
there.
For free at some point.
Oh, is it? Okay. But I checked the other day. It looks pretty good. There's obviously Evel Knievel comparisons to be made.
Well, and he shows up in the movie.
He shows up and says, this is nuts. And
he's sent by ABC because
the guy
ABC
who crashed every time thinks this is nuts.
So ABC is supposed to, you know, have made a deal that they're going to broadcast this jump and they send Evel Knievel to assess the situation. And he shows up and the whole time Ken Carter's kind of giving him the pitch. Like, this is going to be 30 feet high. This is going to come over here. We're going to
85 feet high.
There was something that was 30 feet. Yeah. But either way, he's like kind of describing what he's going to do. And you just see Evel Knievel kind of like looking down. Like he's not even making eye contact with him. He's just looking down. You can see him doing calculations in his head. And he's just like, no, man, no.
Yeah.
And so he goes back and he tells ABC, like, no, this is nuts. It's not safe. It's crazy. You know, I would never attempt this myself. And so ABC pulls the broadcast because they're like, we don't want to broadcast something where we
somebody
know
dying.
The person's going to die.
It's not the wired world of death.
Also, I can't be stressed enough. It was one of the things that hit me is because I was a kid during the height of Evel Knievel mania. And it was like, oh, he's going to do, this isn't actionable. I hope, is it? If I, cause maybe he didn't every time, but it feels like he crashed every single time. Like he'd go around the country and do these amazing jumps at some local show. And, you know, but every time it was televised, it just went horribly for him. So the idea that Evel Knievel comes and looks at your ramp and goes, this is crazy.
He says this is going to be worse than the Snake River Canyon. Didn't go well for Evel.
And of course, it's a tragic story because, you know, he goes for 5 years. They keep planning this jump and there's more and more obstacles and things going wrong. And then eventually the backers screw him. And I don't know if I want to give away what happened.
It does have kind of what I think of it as a twist ending. Oh, another guy who shows up is Dar Robinson, who shows up.
That's right.
Who had just jumped off the CN Tower
right.
at that point. And he says, this is nuts as
well. Really? I mean, jumping.
I won't say the ending, but people should look it up. You could see it on YouTube or on the NFB website. But it's a great story. And in some ways, you know, I was saying earlier, kind of reminded me of American Movie or something.
Yes.
You know,
like, yeah, it's that kind of yeah. Yeah, there's something kind of
tilting at windmills, lovely kind of thing. Yeah.
Although I think American Movie ends up being kind of happier overall.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I was saying definitely like when I first saw Devil at Your Heels, I thought it was funnier than watching it again. And I was like, I don't know if that's because I'm 20 years older now than when I first saw it. And now I'm like, mortality is.
Yeah.
But
death isn't quite as hilarious as it was the first time.
Yeah. Death and crushed dreams is what it's about. So it's like, yeah. Yeah. When you're
a little
older,
you're 20, neither of those are going to happen to you.
Yeah.
God damn it. But yeah, highly, highly recommend it. I can, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can continue on the Canadian tip. Now we can have a kind of a continuity rather than the whipsaw like curves of the earlier part of the show. Rituals. Is the film
the Hal Holbrook
by Peter Carter,
for which we have a commentary on our Trailer Small Site.
Oh, do we? Okay, okay. But this is the one with Hal Holbrook.
This is the one with Hal Holbrook. Yeah, it's got
the one that Hal Holbrook said that he wouldn't have done if he didn't need the money.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, wow.
It's pretty good.
No. I'm sure he was pleased that it turned out as well as it did. But it was not a movie that he would have made, as many people can say in their careers, I think, if things were going better.
Mm-hmm. I guess he needed to finance another stage show where he plays
Mark Twain
or something. But
I'm sure it was wonderful.
Yeah. But being Canadian means that you see all these things on late night television, on CBC Uncut and stuff, because they have the they have a need for Canadian content, but not the wherewithal or I don't know, they don't bother editing them because they're on it, you know, after midnight. That's how I first saw Shivers, and that's how I first saw all sorts of movies, Canadian movies. And but Rituals was one of the very early ones that I saw, and it did exude a real power. It's five doctors lost in the woods. I don't know if you guys have seen the movie.
Yeah,
I've seen it.
Yeah, okay. I guess you got a commentary on Trailers from Hell.
No, I didn't do it. It was David Dakota, I think.
Okay. Anyway, five doctors lost, or they're not lost in the woods. They're on their annual get together, and this time they're hiking through some wilderness, and it was shot, it gets called The Deliverance of Wawa because it was shot near a place called Wawa, Ontario, near Lake Superior.
If you weren't in before, now you're definitely.
Yeah.
Well, there's a place in Australia called Whoop Whoop, and there's a movie called Welcome to Whoop Whoop, which
Correct.
Is like Rod Taylor did it, and he told me, I just don't understand why I'm doing a movie called Welcome to Whoop Whoop.
He wouldn't have done it if he hadn't needed the money.
I had a part for him in the Second Civil War, and he couldn't do it because he had this job. And then he was pissed because Jonathan Skage got billing over him. But that's all neither here nor there.
But Wawa is Wawa. I mean, if you live in Winnipeg and you drive regularly to Toronto, you have to go through Wawa, and your car will always break down in Wawa. So there's something about the place, and so you're not surprised when these doctors run into trouble. And the trouble is that there's a mutilated army veteran who's been mutilated by army doctors, and he lives in the woods with his brother in a cabin, and he happens to overhear these doctors talk casually about medical mistakes they've made. So this raises his ire, and he steals their shoes, so they have to walk through the woods with no shoes on, which is, again, I mean, this is a very Canadian movie, because ultimately it's not even about the maniac, it's about how the landscape will just kill you. But one by one, he puts like bear traps under the water, and he gets one guy that way, and he throws someone down a hill and throws bees after them, and he does all sorts of things. He cuts people's heads off. It's a very scary maniac movie, because you get these evocative shots of them trudging across the landscape, and then in the far, far, far distant background, you'll see a figure standing on a hill. It's very frightening, and it's probably the first, you know, Maniac in the Woods movie. It came out in 1978, I believe. It was shot probably the year earlier, the year before, I should say, and it ended up a CBC late night staple, and it has a great ending. It has a great cast too. Reminds me a little bit of The Thing. It's all male cast, mm-hmm. and they start going against each other, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of bickering, and maybe a little too much bickering in the movie. I'm not big on bickering in movies, frankly. But, there's a lot of it, But
have you seen the Out of Towners?
I've seen the Out of Towners, yeah. And it has a crackerjack ending too. It's very well shot, and it's just an extremely effective movie. And I used to remember that it was a movie championed by Stephen King, but later it turned out when I reread the thing in Stephen King's book, it was his editor who loved it, and King himself never saw it. But I guess his editor loved it enough that he mentioned it in his book. And so yes, that's a movie that I think not enough people have
seen.
Yeah,
although, I was just talking, I'd heard, yeah, it's out of print right now, but there was a Blu-ray a little while ago, finally.
Yeah,
and I think I saw it. I feel like when I think about it, I think black and white and commercials. So I would have seen it on TV as a kid because it was definitely evocative. I saw it a few years ago on DVD. And
Kayla screened it at a festival she used to do in Vancouver, and it was great to see it on the big screen finally. Yeah. So it's very Canadian, despite Hal Holbrook.
It is findable, though. There is still a DVD of it out there, and maybe we'll find the Blu-ray. And it's
I think it's on probably on YouTube as well.
Oh, well, then there's that.
Yeah. Easy to find. A nice widescreen uncut print, in fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I don't know. How do we feel about plugging these?
I don't know.
These YouTube
Peter Carter died in 1982 or something, so he's not around to feel one way or the other about it, but.
I go through a whole guilt thing whenever there was some Elizabeth Taylor movie with Andy Warhol that she shot in Italy. I can't, is this ringing a bell? She was
the driver's seat.
God, I don't even remember, but it was this really obscure film. She had apparently chased, it was in between their divorces, I guess, or their marriages. And she was chasing Richard Burton over, who was doing a more legitimate film. And she made this bonkers.
I think it's that one.
Is it that one? Yeah, I remember tracking down this. It was one of the first times I ever downloaded something through, a shady site. And I went through all this kind of, moral anguish. And finally, it was like, everyone involved with this film who deserves a penny is dead. So I was like, fuck it, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And now I'm, just bootlegging Marvel movies right and left and selling them out of my basement. Who gives a shit? But I'm not. That's a joke. But
the FBI is going to be calling.
I know. Can we joke about anything anymore?
But yeah, it's kind of funny how things become available and then, like you were saying, like things will come out and you'll be like, oh, okay, everybody's seen them now. Everybody has access to them now. But then it goes out of print and then it's obscure again, like 5 years later, nobody's heard of it again.
Yeah, that's true.
But like one that I was totally surprised to find on Amazon Prime when you were saying that you wanted people to be able to movies was Return to Waterloo. So Return to Waterloo is the only movie directed by Ray Davis from the Kinks. And it's a movie, I was trying to think of movies where I've been a programmer in many different countries. And I'm like, what are the movies where no matter where I'm programming, I tend to always program these movies, because they still haven't been played enough or whatever. And Return to Waterloo was one of those movies I would play a lot. And of the two serial rapist movies that I'm talking about on this podcast, this is definitely the one that I would recommend more. But it is
better than Waterworks.
Water power.
Sorry.
But no, my friend, a friend of mine named Otto Bouge, who's a Canadian filmmaker, once was saying to me, because we're both Kinks fans, and he was saying, "Have you ever seen that movie that Ray Davis made that's about this serial rapist on a train?" And I was like, "What? No." And I looked it up, and it's like, of course, if you ever read about this movie, nobody mentions that. Nobody really talks about it. It's always kind of like a man on a train goes through a kind of phantasmagorical journey or something, but they don't really say anything about it. It's like Ken Colley plays the guy. His character is just called the Traveler. And Ken Colley was in a bunch of Ken Russell movies. And he was also in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. He's one of the Imperial admirals or something. So you would recognize his face. So he is on a commuter train basically from Guildford outside of London into Waterloo Station. And it all takes place on this journey as he's on his commuter train and he's going through the ideas that he's a boring businessman and he's a real estate agent. And he has all this time to reflect on his horrible life or whatever. And so there's all these newspapers right from the very beginning of the movie. You see a newspaper that's like a wanted sign looking for this guy that's like the Surrey rapist. And it's basically his picture. It's a drawing of him for sure. And he goes on the train and he obviously, as he's sort of flashing back to events of his life while he's on the train, you realize that, he had a teenage daughter who ran away from home potentially because he was very lecherous towards her. So she has run away from home. He is, you know, it's very strongly implied that he is the serial rapist and that that is not a part of his imagination. His wife thinks that he's just like having an affair with another woman, you know, like she's like something's wrong with him, but she doesn't know what it is. She thinks he's having an affair. And, but it's also a musical. So it's like, as it's going through all of these things, there are songs where people burst out into song, you know, on the train. And one of these people is actually Tim Roth in a really young, early role. He's one of the sort of young punks that comes in the train. And it's like the songs are just about everything from sort of like suburban malaise to like the fall of the mighty England. And like, you know, like the way that he sings about his daughter is like he's totally doesn't take any responsibility for, the, you know, he just thinks like, oh, my baby, you know, grew up and left home or something. And it's like, but all the flashbacks are like, no, you are clearly the reason why she left because you're a gross human. But it's, yeah, it's just kind of amazing how he's sort of in this, you know, he goes in and out of this delusional state of like realizing he's a horrible person and then totally like denying it, you know, and most of it just takes place like in his head during this trip. And it's an hour long special. It was made for Channel 4 in 1984, played once on TV and was never heard of again until years later, it was released on like a double DVD with another Kinks special called Come Dancing. But still, it's,
oh, which is, yeah, yeah.
There's almost no writing about it. If you Google it, it's like, there's nothing. It's really, it's fairly obscure.
Wow, because I vaguely remember hearing of it, but not any of the details you're
well, it's
going
on,
into.
It's on Amazon Prime now. So
they have some amazing, I mean, because they are, you know, the devil company, but I gotta say, Amazon Prime just trumps Netflix.
Well, also for older movies.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, there's some deep dives you can do into. Yeah.
But it's also, it's not like they are curating those movies necessarily. No. It's like distributors can.
They're buying them by the pound.
Upload their own stuff.
Yeah. Oh, is that how it works? Okay.
Yeah. Which is good. I mean, which yeah. otherwise is where are you going to see these things?
But you also yeah. get weird bootlegs and stuff because of
you
that.
You do. Weird. Sometimes it's really shitty quality.
Particularly
on
some of the older black and white movies
yeah,
are
yeah.
terrible dupes.
Yeah.
Have an awful print of a great Bela Lugosi movie called Night of Terror, which is just a real hoot and beautifully photographed, but you never know from their print.
Yeah. But, that's the fun, they're sort of going through some obscure, so I do a lot of obscure 70s films on there, and you hit play and it looks worse than VHS, and you hit play, the next one looks worse than that, and you hit play and it looks like a Blu-ray, and you
yeah.
just never know what
you never
you're
know.
Get.
No.
Which is, how's the well, quality a, on that, by the way?
Isn't it's good, but it's... There was something. Oh yeah, it looked interlaced. You know, like
oh,
it had
that
like
weird,
interlacing
yeah, yeah.
lines on it. So yeah.
Roger Deakins shot it.
Oh yeah, and it's shot by Roger Deakins, yeah. by the way.
So
who doesn't like interlacing?
Yeah.
There's a site called Cave of Forgotten Films, which is on just you know it's on the internet, and they have a lot of really good pictures, some of which in terrific quality of movies that you would never see anywhere else.
I just discovered that. That
including Val Lewton's last picture, Apache Drums,
oh.
which they have an HD copy yeah. of. And it's...
Is it a Paysite or is it
no,
in that
just,
shady area?
No, you just punch it up and there it is.
You wow. can even request things on that site, I think. You can,
yeah,
like,
there is a request thing.
Yeah.
It's a good site.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm calling Roger Deakins is getting an Oscar this year.
I think.
Yeah. Have you seen
I haven't seen that one.
It's
I'll
great.
Tell you what I did see that I thought yeah. looked great was yeah. Which I didn't like the movie at all, but The Lighthouse.
Oh, it's amazing.
A great looking movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just impressive as hell. And also the movie about Harriet Tubman. John Toll shot it.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. Just
really?
Beautiful. Oh. And I think better than some of the movies that are getting a lot of the hype.
Yeah. So maybe I'm talking out of my, I don't know, but 1917 just seems like a no-brainer for Deakins since the whole one-shot.
He'd be getting, is it the one-shot
it's
thing
not
that he's getting? The
shot.
No, of course it's, yes.
Like Rope, I guess.
quite a bit like Rope,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah. But, God, we're so far afield. Who's next? What's, we just did Ray Davis, yes.
We're not afield. this is us. We're
firmly in the, I guess I was going to bring up, and this is kind of, I had to narrow it down because I could have picked any number of weird horror movies from the 80s because I have a fondness for them. I'm a horror movie guy, principally, I guess. But I ended up with Life Force, which is, and speaking of, you know, Ken Russell actors, there's a lot of them in that movie.
Yes.
And there's just a lot of acting in that movie. There's a lot of acting. It's a very, and I love it all. I love all these weird, hammy performances that it's just packed to the gills with. I love Michael Gothard being totally sleepy. He gets like, you know, he gets attacked near the beginning of the movie by the space vampires that it's about. And he's just sleepy for the rest of it. He's just like, can barely keep his eyes open. And he's always excusing himself to go have a nap. And it's a Tobe Hooper movie. It's from canon, which I, as a company, I know you've had some experience with, Josh.
Oh, that's correct.
And so, but it's got to be the most expensive movie they ever made. It's got to be up there. And
it looks great.
It looks great. It was shot by Alan Hume. They just used the crew from the Bond movies at the time, I think, basically, the production designer. And it's got this incredibly weirdly bombastic, uncharacteristic Henry Mancini score, which is, it just, when his music credit comes up in the middle of this opening title theme, it's just, you can't really square that circle. And so the story is basically Steve Railsback and his crew on this space shuttle have gone out to visit Halley's Comet, and they find a giant spaceship in there. And in that, they find all these desiccated bat creatures and these naked humans in these crystal coffins. And they take them back. And on the way back, you know, they I guess terrible things happen. It's kind of Dracula-like because, you know, no one makes it back except Railsback somehow gets, I don't know, gets an escape shuttle or something. I don't, nothing makes any sense in this movie. And then there's this great sort of European space center, which seems to have everyone has an office in it, and they've they seem to live there too. And it's just filled with doors because every time something happens, there's endless shots of people running, like opening a series of doors and running through them. Like 10 million fucking doors in this place. It's all doors. And then you've got Peter Firth, who shows up as Colonel Kane from the SAS. And this is a D-notice situation. He just lays down the law. And Frank Finley, who's great.
That's
great. Great actor. And I know I'm just kind of reeling off names. Patrick Stewart shows up. Aubrey Morris from Clockwork Orange, who's like the creepiest actor who ever lived, possibly in a good, I mean that as a compliment to him. And
a lot of competition.
There's a lot of competition in this movie for, and I guess they're all just trying to out-ham each other or something. And then there's terrific, I guess it's John Dykstra did the visual effects. Yep. So they're very colorful and very sort of,
it's
they
a
have
big
this kind
movie.
Of.
It looks like a studio picture.
Yeah. It's got this whole, it's this Quatermass vibe that, it's like a, the same sort of thing, I guess, that John Carpenter tried to do a couple of times just to make a modern day Nigel Neal script type script.
He even tried to do it with the real Nigel Neal on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, and that reminds me, I did want to ask you because I heard at one point, Joe, that you were supposed to direct that picture.
I was supposed to direct Halloween 3. I had meetings with John. I suggested Nigel Neal to do the script. Mm-hmm. And Nigel Neal suggested Dan O'Herlihy, which is a great idea, I thought.
Wonderful idea.
And then I went off to do The Twilight Zone because The Twilight Zone was happening and this movie was a maybe. And so I just said, look, I gotta go to with the one that I know is happening. And so they went off and made it with
Tommy Lee Wallace.
Tommy Lee Wallace directed it. And it's a very underrated movie in the sense that people didn't like it when it came out because it wasn't Halloween 3 the way they thought it should be, the one that follows Halloween 2. And of course, the whole idea that John had was he didn't want to have to keep remaking the same movie over.
Yeah.
And he wanted to do something different. And every Halloween, there would be another movie in the franchise.
That on a Halloween theme.
On a Halloween theme. Yeah. This is a great idea.
It is.
But for whatever reason, the picture didn't do anything.
I went to see it.
And so when it came time to do the next Halloween movie, of course, it was like, well, let's go back to the ones we were doing before and have the same picture over and over. And they managed to do that for not only several more movies, but several different franchises of the same thing, all of which is the same movie. I mean, there's Halloween 1, and then there's the Howling, and then there's the other movie. There's Halloween, there's the other movie.
Yeah.
But Halloween 3, at least, I think, although there's a lot of dead spots in it, has some really interesting offbeat stuff in it that I think deserved a little better than it got.
Yeah, I'd like to have seen your version, though.
Then again, if I hadn't made The Twilight Zone, I wouldn't have gotten to make Gremlins, and I probably wouldn't be sitting here.
Very true.
it's one of those, who's the lead is Tom?
Tom Atkins.
Tom Atkins, and it's one of those films that even at the time, I remember you know, it was just a given. And I remember there were these movies where there'd be someone like him who was, shall we say, older than a lot of people. And then there's a very attractive young woman who appears to be about 20. And it's halfway through the film where I realize, oh, they're supposed to be having chemistry. I didn't even realize, I just sort of got this father-daughter, and then they hop into bed together, and it's like, there's got to be 30 years between them in this thing.
Well, I think she was going out with Woody Allen at the time.
So, oh, well, okay, so she was prepped, I guess.
Gone out with him or something like that. So she was, you know, she didn't even blink, I don't think.
There's some Clint Eastwood film from the early aughties or late 90s.
I think
where he walks into the bar and there's the beautiful blonde who's like at least 50 years younger than him, and they're talking, and I'm halfway through the scene and I'm going, oh, this is, I.
Oh, that wasn't the one I was thinking of.
Remember, they end up together.
One of his first directing movies was.
Well,
was
Breezy, yes, of course, which, you know, is all about that.
50-year-old.
But that's at least about that. It's like, you gotta tell me that this is even in play, because I tend to think, you know, if there's 40 years difference, we're, you know.
They all made one, though. Didn't Charles Bronson have a movie like that?
Yes, he did, too. Yeah, that's right. Twinkie.
With Susan George. God, how do I know this?
But there's another one with Clint Eastwood where he's paired up with, and her name is Alexa Kennan. That's her name. Where he's paired up with Alexa Kennan. And I can't remember what the name of the movie is, but Alexa Kennan was one of the girls from Little Darlings. One of the camp girls from Little Darlings.
So he's a bit older than her.
And this movie was made maybe a year after that movie, you know. So she's quite young, and they're in bed together, you know, in the movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Every male fantasy.
At a certain point, it just I don't know. I tend not to think a lot about women who are 45 years younger than me, though.
Yeah, that's true.
It's all worth it.
You must not watch much TV then.
Yeah, no, women who are 45 years old are not actually women, Joe. But there's a line. We sort of accept certain things, and then your senses kind of go, you have to make this a plot point. He's old enough to be her grandfather. You need to at least acknowledge this when you're hitting on her in the bar, and it's just not mentioned, you know? I like to think when I'm 70, sitting in a bar talking to 20-year-old women, that I'm probably...
You should only hope.
I'm kidding, honey. I'm kidding. Anyway, sorry. I don't know how we got. So where are we going now?
I think my last movie that I was thinking of was... I lived in Australia for a few years. And one of the interesting things about like moving to different countries and actually being there long enough to become a part of the culture is learning all the movies and things that that everybody knows there that are considered like, well, these are just the big award-winning movies here, you know, but back home, like no one's really heard of them, you know? And so there was this one movie there that, I mean, everybody would talk about it. There'd be, events around it and stuff like that. It was this 1998 movie called The Boys. And I think Rowan Woods was the name of the director. I think is his first film, but it was based on a stage play. It was a popular, devastating stage play. And it is a story. It's a sort of true crime story. It fictionalizes the true crime, but it is an early film by David Wenham, who went on to be in like the Lord of the Rings movies and stuff like that. But he's now a huge actor in Australia. But this was like a kind of a breakout role for him. Yeah. And it's about this family of three brothers that are sort of a, I guess they'd call them kind of a daggy family or something in Australia, which is kind of like a low class, cheap beer drinking kind of. Over here, we would say white trash, I guess, you know, type of family. And so David Wenham's character has just gotten out of jail for beating up a gas station attendant. And so he gets out of jail, goes home, and it just takes place over the course of one day as his family has just gotten some sense of kind of normalcy back. Now that the sort of lead criminal of the family has been in jail, there has started to be better relationships between the other brothers and with the mom and, you know, whatever. They've kind of got an equilibrium going. And then he comes back and then it all just starts to be like this, like these power dynamics building and people, him trying to play different people in the family off against each other, treating the mother horribly, treating his girlfriend, who's played by Toni Collette, horribly. And you could tell this is an incredibly abusive, angry person, right? And he's trying to rile his brothers up to be as angry as him, whereas really you can tell that they just want to go off and do it, have a normal job and live a normal life, but they sort of get riled up into this frenzy of like just kind of like a masculinity, what do you call it? Like they're sort of trying to, games of one-upmanship and things like this.
Kissing contest.
Testosterone.
And, yes. Yes. And so it all takes place over the course of this one day as things are getting more and more sort of fevered between them. And every once in a while throughout the movie, it will cut to something that's, you can't tell at the time if it's supposed to be in the future or when it is, but it's like of them being arrested for something. And so this is slowly building up. And then at the very end of the movie, it culminates in they are about to commit a violent act. And the movie doesn't show you anything. It's just basically showing you this whole buildup to something horrible that's going to happen. And
like an inverse Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. And it's based on, it was inspired by a true case in Sydney of in the late 80s of a nurse named, a woman named Anita Cobby, who was abducted. And the real story is she was actually abducted by five people. Three of them were brothers, but like other two guys. And they just, you know, took her out to a field and horribly killed her and raped her and things like that. And so it was like a, but it was very much like the stage play that was based on that case was very much looking at the sort of Australian lad culture and like this. My friend Alexandra Heller-Nicholas, who is a writer who writes about these types of things, she was saying that, you know, and she's Australian, was saying that it's very much the wild colonial boys myth in Australia, which is right. Something that is based on sort of an old Irish ballad called The Wild Colonial Boy. And it, that song became kind of like the anthem of like Ned Kelly's gang, yes, and stuff. Yeah. And it was very much about this idea of like these lower class men who were like bush rangers and stealing from the rich. And they were sort of like working class, like the way that a lot of people looked at them as though they were like working class heroes fighting the law. And so there's a lot of Australian bad behavior that is often justified by people like calling back to this old myth of like, we're the wild colonial boys, you know? And Alex Heller-Nicholas has cited other movies like Snowtown. There's just like other.
There's another one called Wake and Fright.
Right, and Wake and Fright, perfect
which is
example.
Really, a terrific movie. It was released here under the title Outback, and it was the most damning portrait of a culture that I had ever seen of a country.
Oh, right, they go and shoot the kangaroos.
Well, that's the least of it.
That's pretty appalling.
It was pretty amazing.
Yeah,
film. One of Scorsese's favorites, actually.
That's right.
Yeah, and Ted Kotcheff, who made it, so he's Canadian, right. And he went there and filmed that, and it was kind of amazing because when he tells the story of like looking for the locations and trying to figure out where to film the movie, his story very much mirrors the character in the movie. You know, like all the things that happen to the character in the movie are very similar to what happened to him as, obviously in the movie, it's much more dire, but because Ted Kotcheff, I think, ended up getting along okay with all the people in the town and stuff. But yeah, it's very much the sort of outsider and this very aggressive hospitality, you know, and, it sort of took a Canadian coming into this other country and being able to see from the outside, like how hostile it was, you know?
It's all, yeah, often the case though, that outsider perspective. Yeah. It's always interesting. Yeah. I apologize. I've lost track. Or do you have, or,
I have one
you
more.
Have one more.
I
yes.
have one
okay.
more. My quintet. And this one is Careful, the Guy Madden film from, it was released, I think, 1992. And this is me taking the title of your podcast fairly literally, because I worked on it. It was the first film I worked on. And for me, it was, you know, those movies where there's a young, naive guy and he gets involved with some, you know, like Adventureland or something in some sort of slightly odd situation. And it's a summer long thing. By the end, he's older and he's wiser and things have happened to him. That was my summer on the Careful set. That's not necessarily what I want to talk about. I will talk about the movie because that's what people can see. But it's sort of quixotic, I guess, of Guy, because he decided to make a mountain picture in Manitoba being a fairly flat place. If you've ever been there, I know you were recently in Saskatoon.
Yes, I was in Saskatoon.
And it's pretty flat there too. Yep, I understand.
Very flat.
I've never been to Saskatoon.
Wouldn't make any mountain movies there.
No, but
nice
Guy,
people.
Yeah, well, that's good. And nice people in Winnipeg too, but again, no mountains, but we it's built cold them. There. It gets cold. This was in the summer, so it was extremely hot in a warehouse filming this this mountain movie. They were made out of literally paper mache, I think, the mountains. They were all named after I think Minnesota Twins from the 1960s. There was Mount Quillisi and things like that. but it's a you know, not Leni Riefenstahl. Did she make mountain pictures? Mm-hmm. Yeah, she made some mountain pictures, didn't she? Right. So it's that genre. Guy wanted to bring it to Canada. I think he had to. He thought he had to set it in Canada because of some telefilm regulation, which actually doesn't exist. But he imagined
he didn't have to shoot it there.
Well, he had to shoot it there, but he didn't have to set it.
Oh,
in Canada.
He
believed
right.
It had to be set in Canada. So he keeps showing these weird Canadian flags and. He would tell people, like, say it's BC. If anyone asks, it's British Columbia. But it's obviously it's meant to be, you know, the Swiss Alps or somewhere like that. And everyone has to be, it's called careful because everyone has to be very, very careful and silent at all times, lest he trigger an avalanche. And people are constantly afraid of
avalanche of paper mache.
Well, you know, the standard, like, $6 million man boulders that come down.
Right.
So is there any location shooting at
not
all,
a it? Bit no not even a not even one little bit it's all it's very artificial there's you know lots of Méliès era special effects in it which some of which come off and some of which just terrible that just really don't. There's one shot I feel terribly about personally because I built the set and sort of arranged the special effect, and it's supposed to be a barn caving in with an avalanche and covering all these children, and it doesn't look good at all. that's my fault. It was, so I was on, you know, I was hired to be in this movie or to be a part of this movie. They hired me for everything, I guess, because I'd won some sort of contest, a filmmaking contest in which I won for my region of the country, but I turned out to be the only entrant. So that's why I won. But the prize was they pay for your salary to work on a movie. And so I was hired to be in the art department in pre-production to act in it. I have one line, which I can recite still. Master has an occluded bowel. Alert Herr Dr. Schmidt at once. That was my line.
That sounds like two lines.
Well, I can see why he remembered it though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I asked for it. I saw it in the script and I said, can I have this line? Because I was playing playing a butler student. And then I was the camera assistant, and I had never loaded a camera before in my life. And on the first day I was sent into a closet with a Bolex and a roll of film and in complete darkness.
And no one told you how to.
No. So it was
a braille system.
Wow.
It was a real trial by fire. But I'm going to cheat a little bit and pair this with another movie that people should know about, which is Crime Wave, another Winnipeg movie begins with C. And
I'm completely
John Pays.
See the poster. Okay.
The name.
Yeah, not the one that's
not the Coen Brothers.
Not
the Sam Raimi.
Sam Raimi Coen Brothers. That's what I'm thinking. Okay, no.
Yeah. No, it's
there's an Andrew
movie.
Jatoth one too, but that's 1954.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
This is all one word, if that helps differentiate it. It's not Crime Wave, it's Crime Wave.
I'm just, is there any, there's no enemas in it, are there?
There are no.
That would be amazing if.
I think.
there's think also,
yeah, there's a lot of stuff in it. There's a lot of, there's gore, there's nudity, there's a lot of
there
weird
are friends,
stuff
but no enemas.
Oh! I apologize for my.
We should be talking about submarine pictures like the Anima Beneath. Yes.
Anima from Space.
Yes.
God, if you guys go for about 4 more hours, this will be Night in the Anima. Sorry, Mom.
Thank you
don't
for
listen to this
show
one.
Back to its original.
Yeah, it was full circle.
Talk about Crime Wave. I should not have said anything.
Crime Wave is just, it's a movie about a guy who's able to write the beginnings of movies and the endings of movies, but he can't write the middle of movies.
So that's the hardest part.
Yeah, it is. And it's a screenwriter, a tormented screenwriter picture, like the Coen Brothers, Barton Fink or something like that. So it's in that genre, but it came first. I think it was shot in the late 80s. And it's just, I just wanted to bring it up as a movie that in my mind, I sort of pair with Careful and that everyone should see if you can. It was released on I don't know where you can find it. It's on VHS.
Amazon Prime.
Yeah, maybe.
But also, like, John Pays, who made Crime Wave, was very much the predecessor to Guy Madden. You know,
he was certainly an inspiration.
People who love Guy Madden movies and who are interested in Guy Madden movies would do well to seek out John Pays films, because a lot of that artificiality and stuff that you associate with Guy Madden's movies, John Pays' movies have that.
Well,
also.
Yeah, John was the guy that Guy looked at and said, oh, wait a minute, people can make movies in this town? Well, and he started making.
The saddest enema in the world.
It is on Prime Video.
It is.
Good call. Good call, Joe.
Wow. Yeah.
Fantastic. well, guys, thank you so much. I mean, these are
Something to think about.
It's a running joke of the show. I keep finding myself wanting to write stuff down. Then I go, I'm actually going to hear this again. I don't need to make notes when you refer stuff. But so many here I want to check out. And one I definitely never want to see a frame of. I'll leave it to you to guess. But thank you. Thank you for coming on. This
thank
has
you.
Been
a
blast.
It's a great pleasure.
Thank you to our listeners. I'm supposed to do this and I never do. But please subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you hear it, and leave us comments. That's probably a thing you want people to do. Send money. Yeah. But anyway, thank you. We'll be back next week with more of the Movies That Made Me. Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for the Movies That Made Me.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.